Hello, Joe Gelonesi here. Good to have you along. Time now for another conversation between Clive James and the great poet Peter Porter. This series takes us through the books and the writers who shaped these two men since their childhood. Today they pay tribute to a man they know as intimately as a close friend.
To be or not to be? That is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them. Die, to sleep no more, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished, to die, to sleep, to sleep.
Perchance to dream.
When, in their youth, poets Peter Porter and Clive James left Australia, 10 years apart, and headed for Europe, both had the same ambition, to make the European cultural heritage their own. Some 4 or 5 decades later, they enjoy talking with one another about the books, the music, the paintings they carry in their heads. Clive James begins this discussion about Shakespeare.
Peter, in my mind, you're my Hamlet and I'm your Horatio. You're the interesting, complicated one, and I'm the one who comes on, listens for a bit, and then goes away. And I got this relationship from Shakespeare, and I think Shakespeare must be the number one source, the warehouse for our mental furniture, our range of reference in every respect of life.
Yeah, he seems to have been, rather they say Luther was in Germany, he was the inventor of the English language as well as the great carrier out of all the works that made the English language for everybody else the great thing. I mean, what is so wonderful is that it's rather like the creation of the world. It seems to come from nowhere. I mean, of course, there were medieval literature. There was loads of medieval literature.
There was Chaucer.
It was Chaucer.
It was tough on Chaucer.
And there were some very fine earlier writers, and people like Thomas Wyatt and the Earl of Surrey and so on and so on. But to have this giant suddenly emerging out of nowhere, producing, as it were, the whole of English literature in his own hands, and doing it apparently without any antecedents that we can at least trace to his own personality. We've got the language. And that's why I think people are so snobbish about Shakespeare. He must be the Earl of this, or he must be some learned fellow. Whereas, of course, simply what he was like God himself. He didn't need any learning. He did everything straightforwardly.
He certainly wasn't Bacon, and all you have to do to prove that is read Bacon, who's a greatly talented writer, but not Shakespeare.
I think the thing about Shakespeare for me, you mentioned the Hamlet-Horatio thing. Horatio has, after all, a very important point, because Hamlet goes after the famous scene of the play that he puts on. He has a little song. He says, "Why let the stricken deer go weep, the heart ungalded play, thus some must watch while some must sleep, so runs the world away." Then he tries a second verse. He says, "For thou must know, O Damon dear, this realm dismantled was by Jove himself, and now reigns here." And suddenly he aborts the rhyme. He says, "A very, very peacock." And yes, Horatio immediately says, "You might have rhymed." And there it seems to me is that here is the rebuke. This in Shakespeare there is so often good common sense rebuking overweening and stupid actions.
I think the question of how to read him keeps coming up. It's the kind of question that gets asked in universities. Until we hear this question, we just read him. And then the dreaded question, how do you read him, comes up. But it does pose a problem. When I read Shakespeare, and I'm never not reading Shakespeare, I have since I began to read seriously in my late teens. Despite every encouragement, I've gone on reading Shakespeare. That's the highest praise you can give, isn't it? And only recently I was reading Julius Caesar and Antony and Cleopatra, which I read them all the time, and I read Hamlet every year. And somebody once said that Shakespeare is full of quotations, and it's true. Quotability is the first thing. And I'm not sure that you should ever read Shakespeare purely as literature. The idea is becoming increasingly current that if the novel was available at the time, Shakespeare would have written that. I can't see it. I think he wrote his words to be spoken, and that's what quotability is about. You imagine yourself as an actor. You may not imagine yourself dressed up as Julius Caesar, and in fact, in Elizabethan times, Julius Caesar wasn't dressed up as Julius Caesar. He was wearing a hat, for one thing, as far as we can tell. Mm-hmm. But you do imagine yourself acting it, don't you?
Exactly, but at least, fortunately, in Shakespeare's time, he wasn't dressed as an astronaut or as a member of the British Expeditionary Force in the First World War, which what producers have been doing so recently. I've yet to see a Shakespeare play that's not set in a tennis court or a submarine or a dirigible. I mean, it seems to me that this is perfectly all right in a way, and it's sometimes great fun. But the whole point about the fact that Shakespeare's actors appeared probably in Tudor dress because they had to bloody well hire the stuff or buy it because it was expensive and that was their chief prop, should show people that the works live in their language. Yes, the language has to be acted on the stage, but it doesn't have to have special interpretations by producers.
I think it's one of the good things that the film Shakespeare in Love did, that actually showed you the theatre and the players using a very, very limited range of effects, which was all that was available to them. And you understand why Shakespeare had to create the storm in language, or create the dawn, or the russet mantle clad, or yonder lies Pomfret Castle. When the actor would advance to the edge of the stage, gesture and say, yonder lies Pomfret Castle, it was absolutely essential that Pomfret Castle not actually be there. He was creating it in your imagination. And one of the good things the film did was show how that kind of drama came into being, with the attempt to create through words what the scenery couldn't do, what the stage mechanism was incapable of doing.
So that's why I always stress, I know it sounds contrary to what you're saying, but I don't think it is. I think it's supporting of it, that he was a poet. And one thing that poets can do, they haven't been able to do it recently, alas, is to use language on the stage. I mean, no poet would really, I think, make much of a job of writing a novel. I know people say that they can, but I mean, on the whole, I think poets tend to deteriorate as novelists, but they get better as playwrights. And if you go even as far for as the Restoration plays, you find that people like Congreve, who were not very good as poets, were very good as playwrights. And it seems to me in many respects that the reason why Shakespeare's plays work so well is not just that he had a natural understanding of people and that he was interested in how human actions take place. It was because he knew exactly how language could be mosaicked, as it were, into a real life experience.
And he gives everybody something to say. I think it's one of the things Keats noted in his, when he was reading Shakespeare, he would note in the margin on the high quality of what he called the by-writing. The writing was good when it didn't need to be good. Like when somebody comes on and has one line to say, it's a very, very good line.
Exactly. I mean, for instance, in Antony and Cleopatra, the greatest speech, or perhaps it isn't the greatest speech, the one everybody remembers, the throne she sat on, you know, burned on the water, etc.
That's Enobarbus, isn't it?
It's Enobarbus that does that. And Enobarbus has given a lot of sort of jokey things that good things to say. I mean, some of the most moving lines are given to minor actors. For instance, the description of Cleopatra's ship turning at the Battle of Actium. This is the wind upon her like a cow in June on the sails. This is given to a minor character. I mean, everybody quotes that example of Shakespeare as a country boy. He knew that cows turn side on to cool down in summer. But the point about it is not so much the reference and the knowledge, it's the fact that the lines are fed with a wonderful democracy to all the characters in the plays.
It is amazing as the years go by, if you actually reflect on what's in your mind that you've taken from him, that is actually there in the storehouse, there seems to be no end of it. A single word for me will trigger a dozen lines of Shakespeare that I've got in my head, and they got there simply through love. I never sat down to study or remember. They just got in. For example, I can tell he was fond of the word all, which I think now in the 20th century we would regard as a fairly cheap effect. But for him it made things very vivid. He would say, call to me all my sad captains. He liked the sound of that word. All the conspirators save only he. You can tell which words he fondled, because he fondled nearly all of them. But he had his favourites. And when you search your mind, you'll find these words connecting up line after line after line after line, way back into the distance.
I think it was Tom Gunn pointed out that the effect of Shakespeare's magnificent control of prosody, had to say how the actual lines go along. And he's by no means always regularly iambic pentameter. I mean, he puts in lots of disturbances. But on the other hand, the way he puts words together, for instance, in Measure for Measure, occurs the line, why all, here's your all again, why all the souls that were, were forfeit once. And there were those two words hinging on each other in the middle of the line. And this is the kind of thing, I suppose it came naturally. Everything comes natural, but the point about a genius is that what comes natural to a genius looks a little bit more like an improvement on nature. And I think that's the great thing. It is indeed true, I think, that without necessarily having learned anything, I mean, I suppose I picked up things from listening to Laurence Olivier's old recordings of Henry V. And anyway, to this day, I do an arpeggio on certain point. I go within a month. I do that sort of thing because I heard Olivia do that, and I took rather shocked to me to discover I didn't sound like Olivia. But the thing is that I picked up Shakespeare, I think, purely through the experience of the language is so well stamped that once it's been stamped on you, it doesn't go out of your mind. You don't sit down deliberately to learn it. I mean, I would be a very poor actor anyway because I can't remember lines, but I'm sure it'd be easier to remember Shakespeare's lines than almost anybody's.
I often remember the way the actors did them from the movies when I was a child, especially Olivia's Hamlet and Mankiewicz's Julius Caesar. So for me, Mark Antony is Marlon Brando, which is rather disturbing in a way because it was one of the very few roles in which he was even halfway intelligible. But when he had the right words, of course, he was. But this physical acting out of the line, I think, is fundamental to one's response to Shakespeare. And this is why I doubt the validity of thinking that his later manner was an advance. Now, you could say that the Titian's later manner was an advance in his painting. It was a reduction of means in order to increase the effect. There was an unfinished element, as in Michelangelo's late statues, which released a new layers of meaning, new resonances. I'm not so sure that Shakespeare's famous later manner actually does this. And I read The Tempest again recently and got no more out of it. I find it very, very hard to love because I don't find it very quotable. And I think Frank Kermode, in his recent book, actually advances the very, very bold thesis that maybe Shakespeare's later manner even puzzled the theatre-goers, that the groundlings were saying the equivalent of, what's this then?
I noticed, for instance, in The Tempest that there are more these and thous than there are. There's more yous in the earlier plays. But I think the reason for this is that I mean, it's a cliché, but I think that his later plays reflect a grimmer experience of life. I mean, there is a theory, isn't there, that in plays like Troilus and Cressida, and right through, in fact, Measure to Measure, Measure for Measure, and straight through, really, to The Winter's Tale, you have a lot of scatological language, but also medical language. And the theory goes, doesn't it, that his son-in-law, Dr. John Hall, would feed him at table titbits of the horrors of the dissecting room and things of that sort. I don't know whether there's any truth in this, but I think in some way what you and Kermode are saying is right, that the later language is not necessarily an improvement. It may even be, as you say, a sketchier use of language, but it is very bold indeed in its refusal to find the necessary connective. Sometimes he just puts the things together. I mean, I find The Winter's Tale one of the most terrifying plays of all, and I think Bernard Shaw was quite right who said that as a study of jealousy, Leontes is a far better example of what jealousy really is like than Othello. Othello is given far too many reasons to be jealous. The good thing about Leontes is he has no reason to be jealous, and their jealousy hits him like a kind of storm.
I think in Anthony Burgess, in what is still the best book, fictional book, and indeed book of any kind that I've read about Shakespeare, which is nothing like The Sun, he advances the theory that Shakespeare's later manner is governed by a final waking up to the horrors of reality brought about through syphilis. And it's a bold idea, and it hangs together. Also, Burgess's general point that the lyrical and loving element in Shakespeare is a reaction against the horrors of the world, against seeing people hang, drawn and quartered at Tyburn, I think is very bold and very true.
I agree. I mean, I think it's a mistake, though, to see Shakespeare, I think, as entirely at the end of his life some kind of misanthropos. He remained also philanthropos. I think this is the great thing about him as artists go, and I suppose the same is true of certain geniuses like Bach and Mozart, that you've got here the whole person. Shakespeare paints with the full palette. He doesn't paint with just one fashionable set of shades. And the great thing about it is that you also find in characters like Rosalind and Viola, you find a quintessence of femininity, which makes it impossible for anyone to believe that Shakespeare did not understand females. I mean, and I certainly want to stress the nastiness, because I do think that Timon of Athens and Troilus and Cressida, which are two of my favourite plays, are distillations of hatred of mankind. Yeah. But at the same time, there are so many plays, including even the End of the Tempest, which shows how beautiful mankind is. I mean, it's not just a joke, it's not just a satire for Miranda to say, oh, brave new world, it has such people in it. Yeah. I mean, there is genuinely there going on in Shakespeare's mind the fact that the world is, you know, poised between these two poles.
And that's a quotable line from The Tempest, so I was wrong to that extent. Miranda is certainly a great female role, played, of course, even then, by a boy, which I think is always worth remembering, and once again is gives you a clue to the elevation intensity of the language, because the language had to create femininity. The actor can only do it up to a point.
Precisely. I think that's exactly the point, and I think that this is the artificiality which leads to reality. I think so great, and Shakespeare is the greatest realist of all time, yet at the same time he's the greatest artificer in that he can create these things. I do think it's much better to put your sexy lines in a boy's mouth than to put them in that of Gwyneth Paltrow. I mean, it seems to me that it works so much better that way.
Eternity was in our lips and eyes, bliss in our brows bent. It sounds better coming for a little boy, doesn't it?
I mean, but you can't. This introduces a topic which is important to me. I hate the present day tendency, especially among American academics, to try to historicise Shakespeare, to say we can't possibly understand him in our terms. We have to understand him in his terms, and then they try to create what his terms are. I even wrote a little poem myself, which you may permit me to quote, which is an attack on this sort of Shakespeare historicism. It says Shakespeare on original instruments. Bearbaiter's breath, the Walsingham snivel, Jack Cade's diphthongs, Joy's Jesuit screams, boy choruses, simpers, a king's dribble, an end to radar decadence. So it seems to me that it's silly to try. I mean, it may be a cliche to say he was not for an age but for all time. The truth of the matter is that he affects us as we are now. We do not have to build scaffolding of Tudor times to understand him.
Yeah, because I think the unintended tragedy we face now in the theatre is that it can do anything. And in a theatre that can do anything technically, you can't have Shakespeare, because everything depended on the limitations which he transcended. But even if Shakespeare's plays were no longer performed, which of course they always would be, his effect on other writers is almost the number one problem you have to face after his death, the number one critical problem. Simply the way his lines got into our titles. I was just thought of another one, Call to Me All My Sad Captains. Mm-hmm. And My Sad Captains is a title of a book by Tom Gunn. Mm-hmm. All the Conspirators is a title of a book by Isherwood. And you could go on forever finding titles that were taken. Nothing Like the Sun itself is taken from Shakespeare. And when one artist puts such a repository, a mountain of referential material into the language, he actually alters reality, because no writer coming after him can ignore it. Ignorance is no protection. It will get to you anyway.
Precisely. And I think that in a way he was able to do this for reasons which people today can't. We have such a massive information to put through our sieve today that the kind of immediate reaching out for proverbial statement is almost lost to us. We can all sit down and do cod aphorisms. We can all sit down and create Lichtenberging, jokes. But we don't have Shakespeare's freshness of breath. We don't have that sense of, we've got him, you see. He doesn't have to have us. And that's one of the things which makes it so difficult.
And we know too much anyway. And actually, what about the coast of Bohemia? Was it a big advantage to him not to know things? I mean, he'd never been to Norway. Maybe if you haven't seen Dunsinane, Elsinore. He hadn't seen Dunsinane either.
No,
in fact, it's quite likely he was never in a castle, except maybe Warwick Castle. There's a theory he was there once. But it really helped him not to know things, did it not?
Indeed. I mean, I don't think he gave a damn where the coast of Bohemia was, because he doesn't care about things like that. I mean, you know, everybody jokes about the fact that in Troilus and Cressida there are references to clocks that hadn't been invented and all kinds of things of this sign, and it was told that Aristotle is supposed to do this or other, and this is happening in the Trojan Wars when Aristotle was a little late on the scene. None of this matters in the least little bit. I mean, because we all know, really, that what Shakespeare was interested interested in was what was the idea of Italy. I mean, when he has Petruchio say, doesn't he, you know, the great desire. No, it's not Petruchio, it's Lucentio. The great desire I had to see for Padua, cradle of the arts. Shakespeare almost certainly knew that Padua was an important city in the North Italian plain, and he knew a lot about Renaissance, and he knew a lot about the literature inherited from the past. But he didn't have to know, you know, what the main strata was and where the roads led and these things of that sort.
You think, I think in Julius Caesar, they're, not only are they wearing hats, as I mentioned, but I think a gun goes off. Do you think he really did not know that the gunpowder was not available to the ancient Romans?
No, of course he knew. I mean, anachronism can be overdone. Most of us are far too fond. I mean, Christopher Logue's translations of Homer, which are anathema.
Which are quite brilliant.
I don't like them. I find them anathema, but they're full of Achilles arriving by TWA jet and that kind of thing. I mean, I don't mind anachronism. It's great fun because, in fact, the circumstances are the same in both cases, but sometimes it can be ludicrous. There's nothing ludicrous in Shakespeare. There's just merely an indifference to the likelihood of a metaphor actually belonging to the time in which it's inserted.
Nevertheless, there is a great lust, no doubt mainly among pedantic minds, to put Shakespeare physically into Italy to account for what he seemed to know, to make him a traveller. And it is one of the great paradoxes of cultural history, and one well worth bearing in mind. The culture is coherent only in retrospect. And while the greatest writer that ever lived was functioning in England, the biggest and still the best ever Renaissance in the arts was reaching its peak in Italy, and as far as we know, there was just no connection. He wasn't there, was he? He didn't know about this upsurge of creativity. We do, but he didn't.
No, he didn't. What he did know, and Webster, his colleague, knew, was that during the change from the what you would call the Comune in the early Renaissance to the High Renaissance and the Signoria, that we got a lot of crooks and villains and fiends
and
monsters and daggers and poisoned yeah. Bibles and
boys and women.
Yes, all this thing happening all the time. And so it was good. The thing that amazed me about Shakespeare, and I don't want to make him sound too much like a scoutmaster, is that how extraordinarily sort of healthy a mind he had compared with those of the dramatists that were living alongside him. He doesn't have this ridiculous obsession with horror, which you get he knows the world, in fact, you get in with Webster and Turner and people like that. It seems to me that the great thing about him is that he knows the world is too awful a place to want to decorate it with Grand Guignol.
And even for Oprah Winfrey or professional sentimental sympathizers with the human condition, there ought to be enough in Shakespeare to prove that he was well ahead of us. That there's a great moment in Macbeth when, I forget who it is now, you're going to remind me, is weeping for his murdered children, all my pretty ones. There's that all again.
Yeah, that's the Macduff, isn't it?
That's Macduff, that's right. Yeah. And that's something new in the world because of its intensity, because of its unmanningly tender expression. And for Shakespeare to see that tenderness as a true strength is really leads to us. That's really the beginning of the modern age. You're saying goodbye there forever to the cruelty of the far past.
And you're also saying goodbye to it in verse, which is incredibly powerfully put together, and even more so than in, say, the humane statutes of Montaigne, that you're actually doing it in a form of art rather than a form of philosophical persuasion. I mean, in that scene where Macduff goes to the English court, and Malcolm is trying to persuade him that he would be even worse than Macbeth if he were put on the throne. Macduff has the amazing line which encompasses practically all of Milton, where he says, "Angels are bright still, though the brightest fell." Yeah. And this is the kind of thing which you appreciate, that Shakespeare has simply had the kind of mind, this is going to sound absurd, the kind of mind that God is supposed to have if we knew what kind of mind God had, in that he does take sides, yes he does, but he simply sees more sides than anybody else has ever seen.
Doesn't sound in the least absurd to me. Peter, Shakespeare is all we've talked about, and we've got the rest of the English 17th century, which is extremely fruitful century, and not all because of him. There are people who tried to do other things as well. And we mentioned the Italian Renaissance, which I thought sure for both of us is a great source for what we call an education, which is really what got into our heads in spite of ourselves. And maybe next time we should go back and talk about that.
Yes, I think we should.
Peter Porter and Clive James on Shakespeare, the third in their series of conversations. Next week at this time, more on the influence of Shakespeare on the following generations of English poets and playwrights. You can find details under special broadcasts in the drop-down menu on the RN website. And there you'll also find a link to Clive James's own website, where you'll find his latest poem, written in 2012, called Procedure for Disposal. I'm Joe Gelonesi. Join me at the same time next week.